This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll listen to Terry's interview with David Sedaris. But first, the creator of AMC's Mad Men, Matthew Weiner. Terry spoke with him earlier this week and began the interview's broadcast this way.
Midway in our life's journey, I went astray from the straight road and woke to find myself alone in a dark wood.
That's a scene from the beginning of the first episode of the sixth season of Mad Men, with Don Draper reading from Dante's Inferno, bringing darkness to the sun-drenched beach in Hawaii, where he's lying in the sand alongside his current wife, Megan. They were brought to Hawaii by the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, whose ad campaign Don is developing. I've got a lot of questions about where this season is heading, especially since next season will be the final one. Here to answer those questions is the creator and executive producer of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner. We're going to talk about a lot of plot developments that have happened so far this season, but we won't give away anything that hasn't already happened. If you're not caught up with this season and don't want to know what's happened so far, you can always podcast the show or listen on our website when you're ready. Let's start with another scene from this season's opener. After returning to a wintry New York from Hawaii, Don is pitching his ad campaign to execs from the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. The graphic is an image of a beach with a man's clothes sitting in a pile and footsteps in the sand leading into the water.
I think we're not selling a geographical location. We're selling an experience. It's not just a different place. You are different, and you'd think there'd be an unsettling feeling about something so drastically different, but there's something else. You don't miss anything. You're not homesick. It puts you in this state. The air and the water are all the same temperature as your body. It's sensory, the music, the fragrance, the breeze and the blue. Stan?
It's just a sketch.
Hawaiian legend has it that the soul can go in and out of the body, but that it usually leaves from a leeward point into the waves. Hawaii, the jumping off point.
So, what happened to him?
He got off the plane, took a deep breath, shed his skin, and jumped off.
I assume this is a photograph.
Four color.
That water is transparent. Well, I suppose it reminds me a little of the cinema. But mostly I see James Mason at the end of that movie walking into the sea.
What is that movie?
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
He's killing himself. I don't think they show it, but he's going to swim out until he can't swim back.
That may be a personal association for you, but that's not what this means.
We looked at this. None of us thought of that.
A Star is Born.
The copy is all about the Hawaiian legend. Aloha means hello and goodbye.
I'm sorry, but this is very poetic.
Thank you.
Where's our hotel? Where's the Pink Palace and Diamond Head? You gotta have Diamond Head in the shot.
Anyone can do that.
I don't agree.
Matthew Weiner, welcome back to Fresh Air. I am really enjoying this season. Thank you.
That's great to hear,
so much,
Terry,
for being here and for bringing back Mad Men. So before we pull back, let's talk specifically about this Royal Hawaiian ad that Don has pitched to the hotel people. He's managed to work into his ad the basic desire for a transformative vacation and his death wish. That's a lot to get into one ad. I don't think he's
aware
that he got that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So can you just talk about how you came up with this ad?
Well, the way that the ad came about was trying to express this desire to get away, exactly what's there. You know, it's called The Inferno, and it's a descent into hell, but it's really about a guy who's having a very complex midlife crisis, and the transformation involves becoming a new person. And I'm very interested in Hawaii. I always have been. Marie and Andre Jacques Matan, who are my executive producers, also have a fascination with it, and we love this myth of what parts your body and what parts your soul, this duality. So the whole idea of coming up with the ad was can Don become another person? He has lost his way. Can he become another person? And for me, it was really about a symbolic death. I have to confess that, like Don, I was not really aware that the episode was so much about death. For me, it was more about transformation. You know, aloha means hello and goodbye. You have to lose something to gain something. Not to sound too bizarre, but the tarot, which is older than the Inferno, has this card that is basically about Judgment Day, and it has this scary image of people getting out of graves, and you think, oh my God, what does that mean? And historically, that image is some kind of semiotic signal for rebirth. Something has to die for something to be born. That's really where it came from. The funny part is that Josh Weltman and Bob Levinson are our advertising consultants, but Josh Weltman, I was saying to him, like, I think the audience can tell that this is a really good ad. And he said, you know, because for me, it felt like a mid-70s ad, even though it's 1967, you know, it's whatever, Christmas 67 when they're doing it. And he said, that is the kind of work that they will be pitching to a client for 8 years and finally someone will buy it.
No, I will tell you what I think is wrong with the ad. Yeah, I think it's a I think it's a brilliant ad for the Bureau of Hawaiian Tourism, but not such a great ad for a specific hotel, because you can go to Hawaii and have that transformative experience and stay at somebody else's hotel.
You sound like a client, Tara. I think when you see the words Royal Hawaiian on there, they get to own that idea.
Okay.
And when something maybe it is more of a tourism ad, I don't know. Well, eventually the hotel's going to be in that ad is what the client asked for, but you really sound like a client.
So,
you're not impressed enough with the groundbreaking idea.
So did you study?
Where's our hotel, says Terry.
Well, I love the idea of the episode starting with Don reading the Inferno, reading this classic book about hell while sitting on a beach that's a Hawaiian paradise. Have you read? I have never read the Inferno. Did you actually read it?
I had to read it in school. Yeah, we were supposed to read all of it. I will admit that I only read the Inferno part of it. We were supposed to read the entire Divine Comedy, and of course, you know, like most higher education, we were given 3 weeks to do it. I did not get through it. I sat through a lot of seminars on the entire thing. There are a few books that have, you know, these incredible opening sentences. And there was something about telling this story when you see, like I said, this midlife crisis. This is a man who says he's midway through life's journey and he has lost his way because mm-hmm. he has gone into a dark wood. I felt that just said where Don was to me. And then, of course, you find out that the book is a gift from his mistress, and you start to realize, okay, well, he's somehow repeating, he's really lost in terms of how he feels about himself.
The whole first episode is immersed in death. Don's reading the Inferno. He meets a soldier who's worried about death because he's going back to Vietnam in a few hours. Don and Megan's doorman has a heart attack and nearly dies but is revived by the heart surgeon who lives in the building, the person whose wife Don is having the affair with. Roger's mother dies. The man who shines his shoes dies. Why is there so much death in this episode? And I think it's like it's so perfect because Don has this death wish, and he's so kind of trapped. His soul has become dead. But you said you were unaware about how
I didn't realize. Well, I mean, I think it's obviously I use death. I mean, let's say death is a theme it's more of a topic than a theme. And for me, now that it's out, the show takes place in 1968 this year, and it is, as far as I can tell, in the top two or three worst years in U.S. history, and it is completely seeped in destruction, and in addition, there's a kind of cyclical sense of like one generation passing on to another, which literally means dying. You know, Roger's mother is in her 90s. There's, you know, when Miss Blankenship died, I tried to sort of convey this idea of this generation that was basically born in barns and then, you know, dies in skyscrapers. That whole thing is sort of being passed on. And what I was really interested in is you can start your story with the idea that this is going to be about an ending, which is also a beginning. You know, what do they call it? Commencement at the end of the graduation? That's what it was about for me, is like, let's get to the destruction. Let's get to the loss. Let's see what is to express the idea that people want to change and that change is afoot. Because as far as I can tell, 1968 is a year about change, about revolution, violence, people turning inwards as the community breaks down. So I really kind of wanted to get that into the personal story of Don, which is, I don't like the way I am. Where will that go? And the doctor is a man who deals with life and death all the time. I always feel, you know, you say Don has a death wish. The death wish is something that I know about from my education. It's in the pilot of the show. It's talked about as like a way to sell cigarettes. I feel like Don is, like a lot of existential characters, brave in the face of death, but deeply, deeply afraid of it and trying to find some purpose and some control over it because he is aware of the sort of meaninglessness of life. So I think he's looking on how to, let's say existentialism is a young man's game. As he's getting up there, he is saying, like, why do I keep repeating this? Why am I in this process? This situation he's in is very much where he was, you know, this could have been the episode right before the pilot.
So when you say you learned about the death wish from your education, what do you mean?
I mean, I read, Freud, A Civilization is Discontent.
Okay.
It's really his theory. It's a very lean book that expresses a strange idea that human beings who will fight, even involuntarily, our bodies will fight for life, when we're trying to end our own lives, even though we have that power. But there still is this idea that we are somehow seeking our own demise. That's a very confusing idea, but it does seem to be part of human nature.
I want to play another scene, and this is
sure.
The opener of the season, the two-hour opener. So in this scene, it's New Year's Eve, 1967. We're about to hit 1968. And Don and Megan and the heart surgeon and his wife, and the wife is the person Don is having the affair with, but of course nobody knows, are all together in Don and Megan's apartment, celebrating the new year. It's not terribly celebratory. But anyways, their evening together is interrupted when then there's a phone call about an emergency and the doctor has to get, presumably, to the hospital. But there's a snowstorm outside. There's no taxis. It's going to be impossible for him to get there. But he has skis in the storage room of the apartment building. So, you know, the high rise where they live. So Don comes with him down to the storage room where they look for the skis and they have a conversation as they're looking for the skis. Don's the one who finds the skis.
Is them?
Yeah, you see the boots?
What is it like to have someone's life in your hands?
Well, it's a privilege and an honor to be trusted with that responsibility. They're there.
Look at that.
It's time to quit smoking. It's a good resolution.
Well, one lucky patient.
Honestly, Don, the whole life and death thing doesn't bother me. Never has. Guys like us, that's why we get paid.
Us?
Fine. You get paid to think about things they don't want to think about, and I get paid to not think about them. People will do anything to alleviate their anxiety.
And with that, the doctor goes off on his skis into the snowy, desolate streets of Manhattan on New Year's Eve. What a great scene. I even like the music behind it, whatever
it is. It's David Carbonara. It's our composer. He's so gifted. And we really get a really sophisticated score for each episode. And it's very spare, you know?
No, it's really good. So talk about a little bit more about why the doctor, this heart surgeon who saves people from death, and Don, who's kind of, you know, death, despair we've talked about, or his wish for life, but his still kind of existential despair. Talk a little bit more about why they're fascinated by each other.
Well, I think, Don introduces this man to his secretary as this is my friend. And there's almost this like needle scratch experience for the audience and for his secretary. Have we ever heard Don say, this is my friend, ever? He admires this man. He saw him bring someone back to life. And I think he is looking at someone who seems to be very fearless and confident in their control of life and death. And there was an interesting conversation in the writer's room. Tom Smuts, who's one of the new writers on the show this year, knows a lot about the heart transplants and the early the heart surgeons, you know, that was all happening right at that moment in December of 1967. You know, I was raised by a doctor, and there's this sort of the pat answer, which says it's an honor and privilege to have someone's life, and then there is the what we assume could be the real answer. This man has a big ego, and you have to have the strength to cut someone open and risk killing them. And a lot of times you have a bad result. So Don is dealing with someone who is really in the maw of life and death all the time. Don, a man who ran away from the Korean War when he was faced with his own mortality, you know, took someone else's identity and has lived on the run in fear because he was fighting for his life. That cowardice in the face of death is something that he carries around with him. And I think as we get older and older, we sort of wonder, like, well, how do people go to sleep at night? How do you not think about that? And Don is in the consumer products world, where he is really helping people with their diversions. How many times has Don said over the course of the series, well, just don't think about that whenever something painful happens? But what I really wanted to capture was this idea that Don and a lot of people's bad behavior is just a response to anxiety. And you will even give your power over your own life to another person to not feel that anxiety, that anticipation of demise.
So I want to skip to another scene. And this is,
sure.
Megan has told Don that she's gotten her first romantic scene. They're expanding her part. She plays a maid. And the husband in the couple that she works for, she's about to have an affair with him. And Don is very upset that, you know, Megan's going to have this love scene. He's very possessive of her, even though he's cheating on her because he's Don Draper. So he's never been to the set before, but on the day of the love scene, he shows up on the set. And, you know, he's there, like, watching the love scene. And, of course, watching him, and one of the actresses on the set comes up to him and says, oh, you love to watch, do you? And of course, we're reminded of the scene where he's watching through the peephole in the whorehouse when his stepmother is having sex with his Uncle Mac. But anyways, so after he watches this scene with Megan, and Megan has no idea that he's watched the love scene, she goes back to her dressing room, and they have this big fight there. And here's the fight.
What are you doing here?
Because you didn't want me to see that?
No. And I don't understand why you'd do that to yourself.
It's a hell of a lot better than letting my imagination run wild.
The first time you come to set is for this. I've been here for months. What did you think was going to happen?
I didn't expect you to enjoy it.
It's acting, Don.
Were you going to brush your teeth, at least, before you came home?
I'm sick of tiptoeing around you every time something good happens to me. This is my job. No, my career.
You kiss people for money. You know who does that?
You couldn't stop it, so I guess ruining it was enough for you. Would you rather have not known? You never watched the show. It'd be like it never happened.
Why don't you have dinner with Arlene and Mel tonight? They're much more open-minded.
That was a reference to two people who invited them for a foursome, two people from the soap opera. So, you know, he's really talking about himself here. He's the one who grew up with prostitution. And he's the one, he says, like, oh, you're going to brush your teeth before you come home? I mean, he has sex with their neighbor, and he never seems to shower before he goes home.
He does shower. This episode
was
written by...
How do we know he showers?
Sometimes we see his hair is wet.
We do?
Yeah, I think so.
How can
I mean,
we tell
I don't know. I mean,
his wet hair and the kind of brill cream
I know.
Stuff he uses.
That's a great help for us. this episode was written by Erin Levy, and one of the things that she was doing in this, and that we were trying to do with the episode, is Don has had a client cheat on him in this episode. He has cheated on the client, and then the client has cheated on him, and these issues of pride. And his possessiveness, and honestly, yes, he's a hypocrite. He's the one who was reading into this. There's no doubt about it. I think he's okay with her kissing this guy on the show on some level. But once he sees that Peggy has stolen his act, Peggy uses a phrase that we've heard Don use about changing the conversation when you don't like what's being said about you, and Don has to sit out there and hear it and realize that his protege has basically stolen his act. and that he's been lied to, and that they've lost a client because they went behind their back and cheated on this client, and then the client cheated on them, that rejection is the thing that makes him go and want to stick his finger in his wound. And he doesn't like to watch. He can't help it, like most of us. He would rather know than be made a fool of. So you're just dealing with all the issues of abandonment, rejection. I can't. You'll have to watch to see what this is about on some level. But I think emotionally, everybody feels it. Whether they're sickened or not, they know what it's like to have this irrational jealousy that has nothing to do with your own behavior.
How much do you want us to hate Don Draper? Because as much as, speaking for myself, as much as I, you know, to some degree empathize with his existential crises and, you know, sympathize with it as well, he's such a hypocrite. He's such a louse. He so mistreats his wife that I just get so angry with him. And I just want to know how angry do you want me to be with Don Draper? How much do you want me to dislike him as opposed to feeling some sympathy for his existential crisis?
I'm going to sound like an idiot here. I don't want you to dislike him at all. I don't dislike any of these people. I am not judgmental when I am in drama or in life. And I think that you are supposed to identify with the dark parts of yourself. And yes, you can reject them the way you know, people have incredible morality when they're watching other people do things. you know, it's kind of like staring at it in the mirror and seeing something you don't like. This is human behavior. The Ten Commandments, whether you believe they were handed down from God or written by human beings, are a reflection of our worst qualities. And most of us break a bunch of these. So Don has a reason for why he's doing what he's doing. He is not an evil person. He has, like all these characters, a lot of darkness in him. And he is what I want you to do, and I'm not going to reveal anything more, is to have an investment in the fact that this man is now in his worst state the way 1968 is. His id is overrunning his life.
Okay.
And it's the beginning. You know, it's page one in the story. So, you know, he's going into hell. This is the descent. Maybe he'll come out on the other side, or maybe he'll just take up residence there.
Oh, you brought up what the end is going to be. You know, I think about this every episode. Like, how is it going to end? What happens to Don? I keep thinking, well, he's got to either die or go through this utter transformation and maybe even shed the Don Draper identity. It's too late to return to Dick Whitman, but maybe there's a third identity. So, you know, I know you're not going to tell me, and I'm not going to ask you to.
Next time.
I don't even want to know.
Next time, exactly.
But I'll tell you something that I keep thinking about. In the previous season, there was an episode in which Don's in his office. He presses for the elevator. The door opens, and the elevator itself is not there. There's just a big drop in the shaft. And had Don stepped into the elevator without looking first, he would have just fallen, kind of like he falls in the opening graphic in the credit sequence mm-hmm. of Mad Men every week. And I keep thinking, like, what was that about? Well, it's got to have an echo someplace. Like, I keep...
Well, you know what?
There's so many elevators. This year, he's always up and down in the elevator because...
Well, you know, the elevator is a great place to tell a story in New York City. And it's also a great place to tell a story when you don't have a lot of money to make your show. I will say that. And you really have to figure out, like, how long the ride is and what elevator are they on. And are you going to push this conversation longer than it could possibly be? But, you know, 16 floors, whatever. My wife, Linda Brettler, is a big contributor to the show. She reads the scripts and so forth and really weighs in on things. And later in the process, each year, actually, it's gotten more helpful for her to see, like, what I'm trying to do and then weigh in on it. And she had a dream or whatever. That episode's called Lady Lazarus. It's the one where Megan quits, where Megan rejects Don's way of life. And Don doesn't even know how painful it's going to be. And she pitched this idea that he opens it and sees that that elevator is not there. And to me, it is real physical danger. I almost dodged a bullet. But what it was really about to me is, like, how do I convey to the audience that this man Because we've seen him react to things. He's going to drink. He's going to go and bang some stranger. He's going to medicate in whatever way he does. How do we express the deep feelings of loss that he has as he says goodbye to his wife, to his idealized version of his romantic relationship? He's trying to be a good guy. He's trying to be a modern man on some level. It's a very period story we were telling, that he could not deal with his wife going off and pursuing her job. The most period one we've done, in a way. And the looking to the elevator was, a cinematic way to feel the abyss. Is he literally going to step into an elevator shaft? I think the audience would hunt me down and kill me if that happened.
You mean in the final episode?
Yes.
My guest is Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men. So where are you now in terms of thinking about how is it going to end? Because there's this season and then there's one final season. And I'm not asking you to give away anything. Obviously,
no,
I don't want to be coy about that or anything. But I'm just kind of curious, as a writer, are you already thinking about that? Do you know yet? Did you need to know before completing this season?
You know what's funny is I thought that, because I had these, and I knew it was going to be two seasons left, that I would save stuff for the last season. I don't want to do that story yet. And Andrea Maria, Jacques Maton, executive producers, they're like, you are going to screw the season up. Just put in everything you have. That's what you've done every year. So I try and make episode 13 every season feel like the end of the series. Not the season, the series. So I did that. I just finished shooting. I'm going to be editing the last few episodes of season 6. And then I will take a mental vacation from this thing and come back and deal with the very ending of the show. And there are some things on the wall that I've always wanted to do that maybe we might do. I don't know. Usually stories get rejected by the show and they are never to be. But I have an image, the way a lot of things come to me. It's sort of dreamy concept of what the very, very end. It's not a dreamy scene, but it comes to you sort of in a dream of where I think that the whole thing will actually physically end. But I really don't know what's left to do. You'll see where the season ends, and you'll say, oh my God, boy, did you paint yourself into a corner. I can't think about it. I'm in denial on some level. I mean, I'm the one who picked the end date, but I just don't want it to overstay its welcome. I don't want someone walking up to me and saying, is that thing still on?
It seems to me there's a very fundamental question you're going to have to answer for the final episode. Well, you know, you say right, the end of each season as if it were the end of the series. But the end of each season, it usually ends on an ambiguous note. You know, Don being
you
asked,
know the show is going to end on an ambiguous note. God, people must be prepared for that.
Really? Okay.
I mean, you know what? Honestly, I can't even tell what closure is to this audience. I had an ending of the show where they were starting a new agency. Don had moved into an apartment in Greenwich Village. His wife is on a plane to Reno with her lover and her baby. And people were like, I wonder if they're going to be married next year. I was like, I don't even know what more to say. She's going to get a divorce. I guess when we come back, I could have backtracked on you. There is no closure for an audience that is invested in characters. And I'm the same way when I watch TV. I'm like, I wonder, I know the car blew up. Maybe he survived, because anything's possible in drama.
Well, there's always a thing where, like, Don dies. You know, that would not be ambiguous.
Yeah, I guess it would be, except for, you know, maybe, believe me, Elvis died. It's ambiguous. I'm telling you, people think Elvis is still alive. People could say, well, maybe it was a dream. Maybe Don's really alive. Trust me, the human mind cannot be outguessed.
Matthew Weiner is the creator and executive producer of AMC's Mad Men. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, David Sedaris talks about his new collection of essays and stories called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Des mitraillettes qui reviennent à l'attaque. Bonnie and Clyde. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to part of Terry's latest interview with David Sedaris. Known for his funny personal stories, Sedaris has written best-selling books and is a contributor to The New Yorker and This American Life. Many of the stories Sedaris tells are expanded from journals he's compulsively kept since 1977. Sedaris has a new collection of essays and stories called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Later, we'll find out just what the heck that title is supposed to mean.
David Sedaris, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's been a long time since we talked. It's good to talk with you again.
Thank you.
I want you to read an excerpt of your new book, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. And this is an essay that's both about keeping a journal and also about losing 2 months' worth of it when your computer was stolen. And in this part of the story, your friend's 7-year-old son asks you, what's the point of writing things in your diary? And I'll have you pick it up from there.
That's a question I've asked myself every day since September 5th, 1977. I hadn't known on September 4th that the following afternoon I would start keeping a diary, or that it would consume me for the next 35 years and counting. It wasn't something I'd been putting off, but once I began, I knew that I had to keep doing it. I knew as well that what I was writing was not a journal, but an old-fashioned, girlish, keep-out-this-means-you diary. Often the terms are used interchangeably, though I've never understood why. Both have the word day at their root, but a journal, in my opinion, is a repository of ideas, your brain on the page. A diary, by contrast, is your heart. As for journaling, a verb that cropped up at around the same time as scrapbooking, that just means you're spooky and have way too much time on your hands. A few things have changed since that first entry in 1977, but I've never wavered in my devotion, skipping on average maybe 1 or 2 days a year. It's not that I think my life is important or that future generations might care to know that on June 6, 2009, a woman with a deaf, drug-addicted mother-in-law taught me to say, I need you to stop being an asshole in sign language. Perhaps it just feeds into my compulsive nature, the need to do the exact same thing at the exact same time every morning. Some diary sessions are longer than others, but the length has more to do with my mood than with what's been going on. I met Gene Hackman once and wrote 300 words about it. 6 weeks later, I watched a centipede attack and kill a worm and filled 2 pages. And I really like Gene Hackman.
That's David Sedaris reading from his new collection, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. So you've been writing in your diary nearly every day since September 4th, 1977. How has the motivation changed since the diaries became the basis of your public writing?
I don't know that the motivation has changed. I mean, it's something I think I'm more inclined to get something out of it now. I mean to be able to exploit it later for a story than I was at the very beginning. But a lot of it just has to do, like I said, with compulsion. It's just something that I simply have to do. It's how I start the day, by writing about the day before. But every now and then I read out loud from my diary. So, and I don't read higgledy-piggledy. I just would not open it up and just read. But every now and then something happens and I think, oh, this might work in front of an audience. So I'm always hoping that something interesting will happen or that I will be able to, something I can perhaps connect with something that happened a few weeks earlier. But I don't try to force it, you know.
So why write it the morning after as opposed to the evening of, when it might be fresher in your mind?
I used to write it the evening of, but that was when I was drinking, and that was just when I would write in the evening when I could drink. And then when I quit drinking, I started writing in the daytime because I found if I was sitting at my desk at night, I would think, where's that drink that's supposed to be here? So I just tried to change my schedule and start writing in the morning. And actually, I think I sort of prefer writing it in the morning and just, I don't know, it gives me a little bit more distance from the day before. And then I just look at my notebook and I look at everything I've got in there and I think, okay, what's my lead story?
So I imagine you having these like years and years and years, like years since what, 1977 worth of diaries. I mean, where do you put them? How much space do they take up?
Well, they're actually when I first started keeping a diary, I just started keeping it on scraps of paper. And so I did that for a few months. And then I started using hardcover sketchbooks. And then when I went to school at the Art Institute, I took this bookbinding class. And so then I started typing the diary entries on 8 by 9.5 sheets of paper. and then making special covers and having them bound. There was a guy who used to live in Chicago named Dick who worked at this bindery. And so that was the first time I ever left my diary with anyone. Like, so I would leave it with Dick, who was about, I don't know, 30 years older than me. And I understood that Dick has better things to do with his life than sit down and read my diary. But for anyone even to let their eyes rest upon a page, I would imagine them, I don't know. I mean, there's the you that you present to the world, and then there's, you know, of course, the real one. And if you're lucky, there's not a huge difference between those two people. And I guess in my diary, I'm not afraid to be boring. You know, I don't have a – it's not my job to entertain anyone in my diary.
Is there a big difference between the you present to the world and the other one?
Yes. I mean, the one that I present to the world is pretty much unrelentingly cheerful. Because really, I mean, who wants to spend time with someone who's just moaning all the time? Sometimes I look over my diary, and I was looking over a diary from like 6 years ago, and I'd been on tour, and I actually loved being on tour. But you wouldn't have known it to read this diary. And what I was complaining about was like my hotel room wasn't good enough or dinner wasn't good enough. And I thought, oh, that's not my memory of that time. Like my memory of that time overall was really positive. But I guess day by day, or at least for these four cities in a row, it was I just hate the idea that those little complaints overwhelmed the positive parts.
My guest is David Sedaris, and he has a new collection called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. So we've been talking about your journal and how you've been keeping a journal since 1977, and there's many, many volumes and so on. So I just want to play a very brief excerpt. It's just about a minute from the first interview that you and I did together in 1993. And since you were reading, like, you know, excerpts of your journals on NPR at the time, on Morning Edition, including the Sanilin diaries, I was asking you about keeping a diary. So let's just listen to this brief excerpt of our 1993 interview. How long have you been keeping diaries?
I started when I was 19, so I guess it's been about 17 years.
Do you see yourself as ultimately being a professional writer? I mean, would you like to make a living from your writing, or do you see yourself as holding down day jobs for a long time and just writing at night?
Well, I write in the evening. If I have to write during the daytime, I'll sit down and I'll sit at the typewriter for 2 minutes, and then I'll wonder what my hair might look like parted in the middle. And I go into the bathroom and I do that. And then I sit back at the typewriter, and then I'll say, I wonder what it would look like if I had a mole on my cheek. I draw a little mole on my cheek, or I go and brush the cat. I can't do it during the day. I don't know why. So I need to do something during the day. And I wouldn't want any kind of a job where I'm sitting down, because then I wouldn't want to come home at night and sit down.
Mm-hmm.
So I like a job that gets me out and is physical and keeps me moving around.
So that was David Sedaris, recorded in 1993 when he was still cleaning houses for a living. And David, you know, there's many reasons why I love listening back to that. You know, one of them is that, like, you're so funny and talking about keeping a journal. But also, that was like 20 years ago, and I listened back to that, and I think David Sedaris, when he was saying these things, had no idea how his life was going to change. He had no idea how popular it was going to be. He had no idea how much money he was going to make. He had no idea he wouldn't be cleaning houses or doing any day job. He had no idea he'd be living in Paris and England and flying around the world doing readings. I somehow find that very moving.
Well, when I listen to that, I just think, I mean, I was still drinking then, so when I said, oh, I write at night, well, that's because I would start drinking at night, and then writing and drinking, I just did them at the same time. So, and it's just interesting to me how I was never able to admit that, or how I would hide that, or I would go on tour and then, you know, try to get your booze together for the tour and, you know, every night, and trying to, just how exhausting all that was. So that's that was interesting to me when you played that, like, oh, I don't know why I write at night. And it did take me a while to get used to writing in the daytime after that. But I started drinking and writing at the same time. So when I quit drinking, it was kind of hard to it was never a problem. I never had to force myself to sit down at the typewriter because I had a drink right there, and that was my reward for sitting down. But all of a sudden, the reward was taken away, and I'm thinking, what's in it for me now?
So I'm going to ask you a question, and this is maybe going to be annoying or too personal, so just tell me, and I'll not ask it. I'll just withdraw it. So you and I had a drink once, and this was probably in the early 90s. And after we had a drink, you asked me if I was hungry, which I was, and you suggested we go out for a bite, like at a local deli. And I ordered an omelet, and you, I think, ordered nothing. And you said that you were going to eat later. Is that because you were going to drink later?
You actually ordered an omelet and a baked potato.
Yes, I did. You really remember?
I thought that was such a strange combination. But I didn't. I never liked to drink on a full stomach. So I liked to drink on an empty stomach. So yes, I was going home to drink. But I remembered that, and I remembered thinking, you know, here's this person who I listen to, and there's a person who I admire, and we're going out to dinner, and I can't even eat then. Do you know what I mean? Even then, I have to say, oh, no, you go ahead, and then make the other person feel weird and eat in front of you just so you can go home and get drunk. See, stuff like that, it was the rigidity of that that bothered me. You know, it used to be like I had to do my laundry every Sunday at 6 o'clock, and if I didn't do my laundry at 6 o'clock, the world was just going to fall apart. Everything, I had to clean my house on Saturday, and I had to start cleaning my house on Saturday at 5 o'clock because I had to be cleaning my house when Prairie Home Companion came on. And if I didn't do that, well, I wasn't even going to see what would happen if I didn't do that. Do you know what I mean? Like, so someone inviting me out for dinner on Saturday or inviting me, so it just wasn't going to happen because I had to clean my house. I had to do my laundry. I had to do these things on schedule at the exact same time at the exact same place. And I had to be sitting down at my desk, and I had to be drinking by 9 o'clock, and I had to be lighting the bong, you know, by 11:30. And now I can do things. I can go out. I can – every night can be different, you know. And I think I think that's been great for me, you know, to be able to – to be able to have adventures in a way that I wouldn't have been able to have adventures before.
Well, that leads me to wonder, you know, like when we first spoke in 1993, you were cleaning the house during the day and writing at night. And that took up a lot of time. But you don't need a day job anymore. You make plenty of money with your books and your tours. And that frees up like hours and hours of time every day to do something. And how have you figured out how to use all the time that has been freed up by not having to, you know, have a job? I'm not saying writing isn't work, but it's right. A more flexible form of work. And it's you were going to be writing one way or another.
Right. But
And one of the things about one of the good things about having a job is that it kind of eats up time that you might be spending with obsessive thoughts or, you know, even maybe self-destructive thoughts, negative thoughts.
Well, what I do now, and I love how this, I think it's a really wonderful world that things can come to you the way that they do. Hugh and I got this house in West Sussex, right? And it's in an area called the South Downs. And the Downs are these massive chalk-speckled hills that run for 100 miles between East and West Sussex. And we're just at the base of one of them, right? And our house is on a one-lane winding road, right, that's tree-lined. And it's my idea of beauty. There are forests, and it's just what beauty means to me, right? But English people throw everything out their car window. And the roadsides are carpeted with rubbish. So that's what I do with my life now. I pick up rubbish on the side of the road. I do it on my bike. I do it on foot. The local council has given me an outfit and a grabber. And sometimes I do that, and they'll send me out with naughty boys, right? Like juvenile delinquents. That's what they call them, naughty boys. And to escape the negative thoughts, I have an iPad, and I'm usually getting ready to go somewhere. And I like these Pimsleur language instruction programs. And so, like for our trip to Poland, right? So I studied Polish before we went. And so what people who live out where we, they think that I'm crazy. Because what they see is a middle-aged man who's talking to himself. They don't know that I'm repeating Polish phrases, talking to himself, picking up rubbish on the side of the road. And I'm dressed in rags because, you know, that's my outfit. I mean, and they see me here and there, and they see me every day doing it. I was cleaning up in the village one day, and a guy walked by and said, "There's some rubbish over there," and he pointed. And I wrote an article about it for the Times of London, and then he was at the village shop, and someone said, "Is it you who wrote that article?" And he said, "No, it was my boyfriend." He said, "Well, there's a road right near where I live that needs cleaning. You need to send him out there." And it's like, you know, you can do this yourself. It's not difficult at all. And it's completely satisfying to me. You know, if you clean 2 miles of road, you're going to come back the next day and it's going to be dirty again, right? So if you're like, I'm gone now on this tour. I'm gone for 2.5 months. All hell is going to break loose.
David Sedaris. His new collection of essays and stories is called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.